Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Kaisa Equus Ekman. She's the author of four books, among them Being and Being Bought and Stolen Spring on the Euro Crisis Seen from Athens. She's a journalist and critic at Sweden's major daily. Can you say it, please?
Aftonbladet.
She lectures internationally on surrogacy, prostitution, capitalism, and geopolitics. She's the founder of Swedish network Feminist No to Surrogacy and Sweden's only workers' diary journal.
Arbetarbloggen.
She just returned from the International Forum on Human Rights in Buenos Aires, where she spoke on women and reproduction, among other issues. Her most recent work is On the Meaning of Sex, Thoughts About the New Definition of Women. She lives in Sweden. So first off, thank you for being in the program. Second, thank you for your work in the world, and thank you for being in the program.
Well, thank you, Derek. I remember that you hosted me when I was speaking about my first book on surrogacy and prostitution. And so it was a great talk. I remember that. So I'm really honored to be on here again.
Thank you. It was a really great talk. I really enjoyed having you on the show. So thank you for being again. So I want to start with a quote from your book, and then you can take this wherever you want. Without the word woman, it is difficult for a women's movement to exist. Without the word woman, it is difficult to think and talk about women's situation. Without the word woman, it's impossible to understand the oppression of women. Yet removing the word woman does not rid us of women's oppression. Women will continue to become pregnant and give birth. Women will continue to carry out the majority of all reproductive work on the planet and to own less than 1% of its resources. Will continue to be the majority of victims of sexual offenses and domestic violence. Will continue to be discriminated against in the workplace. Will continue to be sidelined and ignored in medical research. Will continue to be ridiculed and hated if we attempt to reach power. Will continue to love more and get less in return. Will continue to be drained economically, physically, sexually, emotionally. So first off, what do you mean by without the word woman?
You know, all that's going to continue happening, we're going to continue being oppressed as long as there's patriarchy. We just won't have a word for it. And if we don't have a word for it, we won't be able to speak about it, you know? And when I say without the word woman, I'm talking about the ongoing tendency to remove the word woman and replace it with, for example, pregnant person, fragmenting the word woman into different body parts, such as a menstruator or a uterus bearer, making the word woman mean its exact opposite, namely man, so that woman now from now on will be meaning both woman and man. And so on and so forth. So basically, it is on the verge of becoming an impossible term. You know, we don't really know what it means. And if we try to use it in its original sense, we're told that we're transphobic or, you know, excluding someone, God forbid. And I think we have to understand this tendency historically. Because when I wrote that last chapter, if I, you know, go back into archives, historical archives, searching for the word woman, what we see is that for thousands of years, the word woman was used mainly by men because men wrote history and denoting something that they didn't hold in such high regard. You know, woman was meaning something that was lesser than man. Did woman have a soul? You know, did woman have rights? Did woman have a brain? Was she able to think? And so on. So woman was a word that belonged basically to patriarchy. It was a tool of patriarchy to denote someone that wasn't supposed to have the same rights as the man. Now, going back like 200-300 years, to be generous, women started reclaiming the word woman. So women started using the word woman in a sense, not to mean an inferior being, but to mean an oppressed person with a right to revolt. So the powerful narrative that the women's movement had meant that, you know, say just 20, 30 years ago at the end of the 90s, it was impossible rhetorically to attack feminism and the women's movement without sounding like you were some old male chauvinist, you know. So what we have now is in a sense of like coming, you know, from the other side, not attacking the word woman from above, but an attack that seems to come from below to say that, you know, we're not against feminism. We're just against it being exclusionary. You know, we're just against the word woman meaning woman. And so there's this kind of confusion And we're told that, you know, we can just expand the meaning of being woman. It can just mean anything and anybody who wants to be a woman. So what we have here is a word that basically doesn't have a meaning. And then, of course, we can't speak about woman's oppression because woman's oppression is about women. So there we are, you know. And I think if we can't say woman, you know, we can't fight against woman's oppression. But it doesn't mean it goes away. It just means, you know, we won't be able to have a word for it. We won't be able to talk about it.
But you already sort of answered my next planned question, which was, I was going to quote Mary Daly at you. It is impossible to name an act against oppression if there are no nameable oppressors. So how does that fit in?
Yeah, well, that's very interesting because that's what we fought against during like her time, you know, say like the 70s, 80s, when it was difficult naming the man. You know, we were fighting for it to be called, you know, men's violence against women and not domestic violence, for example, or crimes of passion or family violence. You know, there's all sorts of ways to go around naming like who is the victim and who's the perpetrator when it comes to patriarchal violence, for example, or rape, you know, or anything that happens to us. So we fought, you know, trying to name the man. And now we're at like a different point. We can't name ourselves. We don't have the right to name ourselves. And
it seems that's all part of the same. I don't want to call it a strategy because that's too conscious and it's more of a cultural movement. But it seems that's part of the same way of defending patriarchy. It's just the next iteration of it. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, I see what you're trying to get at. And us as feminists, we're often accused of, you know, believing in conspiracy theories because, you know, what people are interpreting what we say as is as if we're thinking that, you know, the powerful guys are sitting in a room smoking cigars and thinking like, haha, how are we going to impress women? Like, yeah, let's just do it through like trans people. Yeah, that's the point. No, that's not what we're saying. We're not saying that, like, you know, the International Olympic Committee, when they decide to make the female category in sports be a question of identification. So anybody who identifies as a woman will be able to compete. We're not saying they're thinking, haha, let's destroy women's sports. We're just saying they don't care enough. They don't care enough about women's sports. And that's why it's so easy to do this. So we already have patriarchy all over the place. And that is why, you know, this channel, it becomes so easy because nobody cares anyway about women's sports.
So let's back up a little bit. And I mean, you talked earlier about woman being a term of derision when written by men historically, right, and women claiming it as a category of oppression. Can we also just talk sort of, I mean, where does physical reality fit into this? Can we start with physical reality and then build up layers of oppression that are based on that physical reality? Do you see what I'm getting at with that question?
Yeah, I see what you're getting at. Well, look, I'm a Marxist, and that means that I believe in something called dialectics. And what I'm trying to say with that is that as a Marxist, we believe both in material physical reality that exists, but we also believe in culture. So there is a dialectic between, you know, nature and culture here. You know, we're not saying, as, you know, the biologist that, you know, there's only nature and that's it. No. And we're neither saying, as the postmodernists, that it's only culture, everything is language and everything is culture and there is no biology. No, as a Marxist, you have to see both. And, you know, the play that comes with both factors. So when you apply that to the topic of sex and gender, what we see here is, you know, there is definitely sex. There is, you know, male and female in terms of reproduction. That is why we have two sexes, because of reproduction. You know, it is a fact that these two sexes are not overlapping. You know, it's not like men sometimes can give birth and women sometimes can produce sperm. You know, these are either or categories. Now, then we also have what, you know, we commonly since the 60s call gender, which is the culture of it, the social construct, the idea that because you are a woman, you should have long hair. And if you're a man, you should have short hair. You know, because you're a man, you should like cars. Because you're a woman, you're supposed to like cute things. You know, these are all like dependent on, you know, contemporary issues. Like they change over time. You know, it depends on what culture you're in. They're not the same all over the place.
The French royalty wore high heels.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and then you can see like most men in, you know, religious contexts are wearing dresses. In a lot of religions, you see like the most holy guys are wearing dresses, you know, for example. So, you know, these are all cultural things, right? So they both exist and come into play when we have to determine like what is a woman today. We don't only mean that a woman is just biology, because, you know, being the experience of being female has to do with oppression, it has to do with cultural factors. You know, whereas nowadays, what's happening with the word gender, which is very interesting, is that gender, when used by gender identity theorists, is used as an individual personality thing. You know, feminists never meant that gender was like some personality that you could choose and say like, oh, I am this gender. Gender is a structure. It's not about you. It's about everything. It's about how they treat you. It's about what they expect of you. It's the whole society. It's not an individual thing.
So because this is all so sticky, can we get even more specific with this? So a little girl happens to like to play football and doesn't like dolls.
Right.
That has nothing to do with gender as you are discussing it, correct? That's just personality.
That is personality, you know, but it has to do with gender, because society will expect that a little girl is supposed to be a certain way, right? So through very, very like subtle means, they will try to make her conform into like the female gender role, you know. So that's where society comes in. It's, you know, she's not free to choose in that sense. You know, she will be forced in. You know, and that's what we have called gender roles, right?
Oh, this reminds me of something I read back in 1990. It was a study of smart little girls. And In first grade, if you ask this smart little girl how to do a difficult math problem, she would answer the question. And by fourth grade, if you ask her this difficult math question in class, she will bat her pretty eyelashes at you and say, I don't know.
Yeah, because she's taught that she will get advantages in life if she behaves accordingly.
And she will get laughed at or, you know, oh, look at Smarty Pants if she knows the answer.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, and we as feminists, we have fought against, you know, this idea that because you are a girl, you have to behave a certain way. You have to have a certain role. We have, you know, had this ideal that, you know, sex is just supposed to be about the body, and that then you should be free to, you know, develop your personality the way you want to, wear the clothes that you want to, play with the toys you want to, have the job you want to, and have an equal relationship to the opposite sex, and not be expected to, you know, pick up his socks just because you are born with a vagina and he's born with a penis. You're the one that's supposed to pick up the dirty socks from the floor. You know, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't have anything to do with a vagina. You know, that's culture. You know, so we've fought against that. And I think kind of successfully still that we've gotten the message through, you know, that why? Because you're a girl, you should be, you know, expected to behave a certain way. So now what is happening is this kind of inverted backlash, where we're told, no, you don't have to behave a certain way because you're a girl. But if you do, it might be that you're actually a boy. So we're not going to stop you from behaving that way. We're just going to tell you that you're actually a boy and that you should undergo treatment for it. So I think the big question here is that progressive, you know, or are we seeing a backlash here? And, you know, me as a feminist, I would say we're seeing a backlash here. You know, why can she not be free to play with whatever toy she wants to play with, you know, without people telling her, aren't you actually a boy? Because what they're saying when they're saying that is girls and cars don't belong together. Girls and short hair don't belong together. You know, so we're still dealing with the same gender roles here. What's different is they're using our language now when they're telling her, you're actually a boy. They're not telling her, you're a girl, girls have to behave this way. Otherwise, you know, you're a tomboy, that's no good. You should be cute. They're not saying that anymore. They're saying, we believe in diversity. We believe in that everyone should be free to do what they want to do. We believe in being yourself, being true to yourself. It's just that in that message, there is a very subliminal message that says that a girl, she can't be the way she wants to be as a girl. She has to become a boy.
Sorry to throw out a fancy term here, but a fancy philosophical term, but it reminds me, whenever I hear any of this, it always reminds me of Whitehead, the philosopher's phrase, the fallacy of misplaced concreteness.
Ah, interesting.
Which is where you think that the wrong thing is real. So instead of it being that the sex is real, and then she gets to do whatever she wants to do, you think that the relationship between sex and Barbie dolls is real.
Right.
And anyway, that always, I always think about that when this discussion comes up.
Yeah. Well, it's weird, you know, because I believe that patriarchy is like one of the most, if not the most pervasive and deeply rooted systems of domination, because it's been around for 6,000 years. You know, it came long before capitalism, long before colonialism. So it's not that easy to uproot, you know, it's going to come back. It's going to find new ways. You know, if we think that because 100, 200 years of struggle, you know, we're going to get rid of patriarchy and now everybody's fluid, everybody's, you know, able to choose their own gender. You know, we're tricking ourselves because patriarchy is much deeper than that. And that's why I always like, I you know, I baffled at the lack of historical accuracy when I hear gender identity theorists speak about, you know, oh, before colonialism, there were no gender roles. You know, it was non-binary everything. You know, it's colonial to believe in gender roles. You know, and that's just not accurate. You know, patriarchy worldwide dates back 6,000 years. It's long before colonialism. If you look at most creation myths in any culture, they will have clear roles for male and female. It doesn't mean that patriarchy is natural. It just means it's very old.
I want to go back to the word you've used a few times, backlash. And
yeah.
I think about how hard women have struggled for, how hard they struggled for single sex bathrooms, how they're still struggling in some places for single sex bathrooms, how hard they struggled being an athlete myself and having been a coach. I coached a female national champion. You know, the sports thing is also important to me. And it's, you know, men opposed women's sports in the first place and opposed women being in sports. And now this is a way for men to damage women's sports. And I agree with you that it's not some, you know, secret cabal that's pushing this. And I think you and I really agree on how backlashes happen. I want to go on for just a little bit more, but and then I want to turn it back over to you because I'm so fascinated by how these backlashes happen. And I'm thinking, like, in the United States, chattel slavery was eliminated with the Civil War. But then it didn't take long for them to figure out the Jim Crow laws, that's just sort of a new way to make the old thing happen. And that fascinates me how, you know, you can think you've won a battle, but then, and I'm going to use the word sneaky, but I really don't mean conspiracy at all. But then sneakily, and the same thing happens in relationships. If you're in a relationship with somebody who's emotionally abusive and you say, this behavior really hurts me, and they stop doing that behavior, they figure out another behavior that allows them to manifest that same impulse. Now I'm done with my little lecture. So can you take that anywhere you want to go, especially with how social impulses lead to new forms of backlash? Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, I see what you're trying to get at. And I like the term backlash. It was coined by Susan Faludi when she wrote about the biologists' backlash against women that came, you know, in the 90s when women had, you know, actually the women that were educated in the 70s went to university in the Western world. You know, the first, you know, big group of women went to university in the 70s had, you know, broken the glass ceiling in the 90s, were, you know, being appointed to top positions all over the capitalist world. And then there was this, you know, biologist theory saying like, oh, women actually belong in the home. You know, women like these cute dresses. Women, men, yin and yang, you know, women are, you know, different than men. Men are from Mars. Women are from Venus. You know, it was that backlash he was talking about. And it was extreme libiologist. Like there was this whole body of research that was aiming to find like the female brain and, you know, making popular science out of it. Like, oh, the female brain is different. The female thinks about small things. She thinks about the home. Men think about geopolitics, you know, all that stuff. But I think the feminist movement was able to kind of, you know, lash back at the backlash and actually fight it back, you know. And now we're facing a different kind of backlash. And I think, you know, we're so used to fighting power. So we're used to, you know, the backlash coming from above. Now what's sneaky, like you were saying, what's sneaky about this backlash is that it appears that it comes from below. You know, we're told we're more oppressed than you. You know, you're privileged. If you're a cis woman, and that's another new word, you know, that I think we have to break apart. You know, it means exactly the same thing as the word woman means. You know, it's a woman. It's somebody who's born a female. You know, that is a cis woman. You know, but if we say that women have a right, you know, to do this, women have a right to vote, women have a right to do sports. If now we have to replace that by the word cis woman, which basically means privilege, it doesn't have quite the same ring to it. If I say the cis woman has the right to do this, it sounds like I'm talking about a white billionaire who's sitting in her castle and who's like wanting to oppress somebody else. So effectively, they've told us that, oh yeah, sure, if you're oppressed, you have the right to fight. It's just that you're not oppressed, you're privileged. There is another woman who's more oppressed than you. And it happens, it so happens that it's the person who's born as a man, you know, which in our theory is the oppressor group. So the person who's born as a man and who now is a woman is more oppressed than you. So you have to give him the space. You know, you have to not center yourself at the Women's March or any type of women's activity. He has to center. He has to be centered. Otherwise, you are the oppressor. And, you know, that's really sensitive to us because we're fighting oppression. So if somebody tells us we're the oppressor, you know, we're like, oh, my God, I don't want to be that bad person. I want to be a good person. You know, if I have to give him my name, if I have to give him my sports, if I have to give him my space, if I have to give him, you know, my bathroom, so whatever, take it as long as like, I don't have to be the bad person. I don't want to be the oppressor. So we're not used to having that place in the struggle. And I think here it's a, like kind of linguistic twist here that makes us, you know, we have to regroup in a sense to understand that, you know, what seems to come from below, I don't think it's coming from below at all.
Yeah, I think the term that comes to mind when I think about all this is the famous term gaslighting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, if you worked with like, you know, men's violence against women, we know how that works. We know that men will say that they're the victim, that she hit them first, that she's abusive, that she has to listen to him, that he feels bad, that he counts. You know, we know how that works. So, I think that's, we would be able to analyze this kind of clearly, and a lot of us are. The problem is that it's really difficult for women when we speak out. You know, we lose our jobs, we're canceled, we're met with violence. So it's a kind of collective gaslighting that's going on here. And, you know, it seems like, you know, the sacrifice that you have to make not to be victim of all this violence, it's just, you know, just give up a little thing. Just give up this word, woman. It doesn't really mean anything to you, does it? And I think that's where the tricky part is, because the women who are saying, I'm fine with everything, I'm fine with all this, I don't care, it's okay, like women can mean anything, I don't need this word for myself. You know, they're thinking that's going to save them from being victims of this whole rage of, you know, backlash of violence, you know, and that's exactly as a battered woman thinks, you know, it's okay, I'll just, you know, let him decide this time and it will be okay. But it will never be okay, because then it's another thing, and then it's another thing. And before you know it, you've lost your voice.
Yeah. And I, from the perpetrator's perspective, I keep thinking about this line by R.D. Lang about how do you plug a void plugging a void. And that's why the demands of the perpetrators are insatiable, is because what they're trying to do with every battering, with every gaslighting, is trying to fill an emptiness inside that's not going to be filled by battering or raping or gaslighting. And so that's, you know, it's interesting. I've had some interesting conversations with Chris Hedges about our experiences of violence, and he was a war correspondent. And one of the things he learned as a war correspondent is that violence traumatizes people, and it does horrible things to the perpetrators and to the victims. And so he and I have interesting conversations about pacifism, because what I learned from a childhood of abusive violence was that abusers are insatiable.
Yeah, they are. I think it's partly psychological, but then I read something interesting in Lundy Bancroft's book, Why Does He Do That? Which I think is like the Bible, because he has interviewed so many abusive men and learned, you know, how they think. And then he gives that knowledge to abused women. And what he says is that he's actually, you know, every time he uses violence, you know, and also this means like psychological violence, you know, economic violence, anything, he will gain something. For example, if he throws a tantrum, you know, when she asks him to do dishes, if she says, could you do the dishes, honey? And he goes like, why the fuck you're asking me to do dishes for? And he throws the plates, you know, on the floor, and he's screaming and there's food all over the place. You know, it doesn't matter if he then says, oh, I'm sorry, I just had a bad day at work. She will never ask him again. For the rest of that marriage, she's never going to ask him to do dishes again, because she knows, you know, there might be a risk of that happening. And the kids are there. She doesn't want to ruin the dinner. So that means for one fit, he's not going to have to do dishes ever again. And so you're gaining something. You're gaining ground by doing this. And I think it relates also to what we're seeing here about women, you know, giving up space, giving up, you know, their voice, giving up their name, is that all of this is giving space to, for example, a failed male athlete who is like in his 40s or maybe 50s, who has no chance to win anything in the male contest. And then he goes into the female contest and he's famous. Maybe people are hating on him, but he's still famous. He's someone. We know his name. It's like when you talk about, you know, the swimmer. What's that guy's name again? Who was
Leah Thomas.
Exactly, Leah Thomas. You know, would we know who that person was if it weren't for the fact that he was able to compete in women's swimming? We wouldn't know his name.
And the women who, the women on the team were told quite explicitly that if they spoke out against him being on the team or in their locker room, that they would have their lives destroyed.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I mean, I'm not surprised, because that happens like micro, macro, it happens all over the scale. And I think it has to happen, because if it didn't happen, you know, we would all speak out. I mean, because it's so absurd. It's really absurd. You know, when it comes to sports, we all know it's not about gender. It's about sex. It's not about what you think or what you feel or, you know, how you identify. It's about what body you have. You know, it's a physical thing. You know, and so I think like most people see here that it's not fair that males should compete in with women. So I think there has to be this like extreme level of harassment for this to be able to go on.
And one of the things that I've been arguing lately is that one of the reasons they have to do this level of harassment is that they don't really have any arguments. And if there is an honest to goodness argument, they're going to lose. So the only way it's okay, here's the thing, is that postmodernism has sort of declared that there is no such thing as reality. And right, that if you accept postmodernism, and queer theory comes out of postmodernism, and transgender ideology and queer theory and postmodernism are all tied in together. If you accept postmodernism, that means you can't win an argument by arguing facts, because they dispute the reality that they don't exist. And if you can't win an argument by arguing facts, so you and I are arguing, and you and I go to dinner, and I get upset at you because you were 20 minutes late, and you say, no, I wasn't 20 minutes late. time doesn't exist.
Yeah, it's right, like, right.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way you know one of the other of us can win an argument. Except with postmodernism, then it's like the only way you can win is by canceling the other person.
But, you know, but in my book, I write that gender identity theory and, you know, what some people refer to as trans ideology is not actually queer or postmodernism. It represents like another step, because postmodernism and queer theory is extremely postmodern, you know, claims that, you know, as you're saying, there is nothing. Nothing exists. It's all language. You know, it's all how we speak, how we think, you know, nothing is real. But, you know, in trans theory, somebody who says he is a woman is a woman, you know, that's fixed. He's born actually a female. He's just happens to have been assigned another sex at birth, but he is. I mean, if you read Judith Butler, that wouldn't be able to happen, because according to her, it's like how you are treated by society. If somebody calls you a woman, then you become a woman. You are nothing, actually. So nobody can say they have an identity, actually, according to Butler. If you read her literally, you know, nobody can say they're anything. So I believe that there is like, this is a step further, you know, in queer theory, everything was floating around, you know, there was like no signifier signified. It was just all floating. But now it's becoming fixed. Now we're told trans women are real women. Yeah. You know, but, you know, I thought nothing was. No, this is, you know, that exists. They're claiming that is real. So somehow for trans people, we're told that there is something such as is, something is real. Whereas we as women are supposedly still stuck in the postmodern fluid state. Do I explain myself here? Because I think that's an interesting discrepancy between these two theories, you know, and which I think Judith Butler has not clarified, because she, you know, initially was criticized by transgender theorists, saying like, how can you say there is nothing, you know, when we feel we are women for real? And she wasn't actually able to explain that. So she resorted to something like, you know, the Declaration of Human Rights and said, oh, I just believe everybody should be free and have human rights. Okay, so she wasn't actually able to explain how these things both went together, you know, based on our own theory. So I believe there's actually an inherent conflict between queer and trans that has not been, you know, actually studied or investigated, because we're told it's one and the same thing, but it's actually not the same thing.
I think what you're saying makes a ton of sense. And at the same time, I think that as we know, when one is rationalizing one's behavior, one does not need to be internally consistent.
Yeah. And I think that's the problem with gender identity theory. It has so many fallacies. And that's what I'm trying to do in my book. I'm trying to actually treat this as a theory. I'm trying to treat this as a theory and understand what it means theoretically. And what I find is that the first and foremost fallacy about this theory is that according to trans theory, trans doesn't exist, right? Because we're told that trans women are women in the exact same way that women are women. So then, you know, they're not trans at all, basically, because, you know, to add that prefix would be to make them different. So they're not different. They're the exact same thing, right? So then we don't have trans, right? Everybody's a woman. And yet, you know, there is still the thought of claiming trans as a separate identity, which is different from being a woman. When it comes to trans rights, you know, trans this, trans that, then it's like, oh, no, this is a separate thing. Right. So this is the really strange thing. I don't understand how it goes together, because when they were asking the Nigerian author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, they were asking her, are trans women real women? And she said, trans women are trans women. And they were mad. I mean, in what world can they be mad because she says trans women are trans women? It's like if they ask me, you know, is a car a car? Yeah, a car is a car. How can you say that? You know, I mean, it's absurd. Because according to that theory, you can be trans and thereby be special. But I, as a woman, cannot be special, because a trans woman is exactly the same thing that I am. But I am not exactly the same thing as he is. I cannot be a trans woman, for example. But he can be a woman, point blank.
I think Mary Daly would say that would say that men get to do whatever they want.
Yeah. And that is like at the end of my book, that's my conclusion. So what I speak about is like the three layers of gender identity theory. The first layer, which is the one that most people just get there, is all about diversity, all about tolerance, all about being who you really are and like living your own true life, right? All rainbows and stuff, unicorns, you know, everybody thinks, oh, that's great. That's tolerance. Like, how can you be against that? Like, you must be an evil person. So that's the first layer. When we get to the second layer, we realize, as I was saying, like, actually, this is a really kind of binary theory, because it's about, you know, if you like cars, you're a boy. And if you like blue, you're a boy. And if you like pink, you're a girl. And if you like to do your hair, you're a girl. And you can see it very clearly in like parents' account of like how they found out their kid was trans. Oh, my boy, my son was taking the towel and wrapping it around his head and saying, don't I look cute? And then, oh my God, he must be a girl. So it's then you get to something that's not tolerant or diverse at all, where it's very clear that boys are like this, girls are like that. And then we get to the third layer, which is what you're saying, that it's a man who gets to be what he wants. Because if we would follow the second layer and say that it's binary, it's about personality, then all these guys that decide to transition when they're like 58 years old and they've been in the military all their lives and they're like classic males, male interests, male personality, heterosexual, married with kids, housewife at home. No, now they decide they're women. Okay, but how can they be women then if it was all about, you know, gender roles in the second layer? No, now it's like if a man says he's a woman, he is, and we can't say anything about it. So we just had a case like a couple of years back in Sweden where it was this Swedish guy, white guy, who murdered his ex-girlfriend, Thai girl, dismembered her, and went to prison for it. In prison, he declares he's a woman. He was removed from the male prison. He went into a woman's prison. So this is a guy who's like, does, you know, a very typical male thing. You know, I wouldn't say like, oh, it's male because all men do it. I mean that it's male because very few women do this, you know, right? So according to the second layer, he's no girl because what he's doing is not girlish. But now all of a sudden he's still a girl because he thinks that. And, you know, the irony of it all is that nobody thinks that. Nobody thinks that because if they thought that, you know, they wouldn't show him all this respect because we know how they treat women. So I think the whole of society, like all this respect and this kind of like, you know, noble like air that, you know, the idea of like the trans woman and oh my God, it's a trans woman. Wow. You know, that just shows they don't think they're women, because if they thought that, they would treat them like shit, like they treat us.
Yeah, it's I saw this line the other day of something about, we know that men who identify as transgender are really men because everybody believes them and they would never believe a woman.
Yeah. It's like you saw that case, like when there was a girl who had transitioned or at least identified as a guy who killed people recently in the US. And I just noticed that it was, I mean, the media was still describing her as a girl and as a woman for the longest time. When if it's a man that does it who identifies as a woman, of course, everybody says she and her and it was a female all the time. No question.
So there's a couple directions I want to go. And everything you're saying is really great. Thank you for that. One of them is, one of the things that bothers me profoundly on this, and this is probably just me being a pedant, but words are very important to me. And when you ask a gender ideologue, what is the definition of a woman? Mm. A lot of times the definitions they give are circular.
Yeah.
Like a woman is anybody who says they're a woman. And that's that. If you tried that with any other thing, like a car, what's a car? It's something we call a car. What's a square? A square is something we call a square. Right. You would not get out of, I don't know how the grades are in Sweden, but in the United States, you wouldn't get out of fifth grade. You would get flunked in elementary school if you tried to say that the definition of a volleyball is a volleyball, is something we call a volleyball. So the definitions are circular.
Oh, even worse, it's something that calls itself a volleyball.
Yeah, exactly. So I learned in fifth grade the definitions have three conditions. One, mm-hmm. is they're specific.
Mm-hmm.
Two, is that they are falsifiable. So if I tell you I'm a vegan and you say, what'd you have for dinner last night? And I say a hamburger, we just falsified my claim. So it has to be falsifiable. You have to be able to prove it's true or not. And then third one is it can't be tautological. Tautological means that you're using the thing to define itself. And there is no, it bothers me on a linguistic level. Even if I didn't disagree with the ideology, it bothers me on a linguistic level that you have a Supreme Court justice of the United States who refuses to define what a woman is.
Yeah.
I mean, if you asked her, can you define what is first degree murder? She's a judge. She should be able to define it. Yeah. If you ask her, can you define what is a corporation? Can you define what is separation of church and state? Any of those things. She should be, that's her job.
Yeah.
So,
I mean,
anything to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's that, like, I've noticed that as well. It's always that definition. But what I always notice as well is that the question is always, what is a woman? They never ask, what is a man? So, you know, is that a coincidence that it's the oppressed sex that is being, like, all, you know, watered out, you know, and questioned and cut up, you know, and fragmented and meant to mean its opposite? Whereas, you know, we're asked, and this is the main thing, I think, in gender identity theory, we women are asked to believe this. But nobody's asking males to believe that anybody who says he is a man is a man. Now, there's no campaign saying, like, hey, guys, you know, if you see a person with a vagina in your locker room, don't do anything, like, don't harass her, rape her, or, like, ask her what she's doing there, because she probably is a man. You know, there's no articles in, like, men's magazines saying, like, oh, men, you've centered yourself too much. Now it's time for the trans brothers, you know. Out of all the trans people who entered parliaments all over, like, the world in the year I wrote the book, they were all trans women. You know, nobody was a trans man. So, like, you know, I think that's a paradox. Like, we're told this is all about anybody, you know, being who they really want to be, you know. And in reality, you know, it's the men benefiting from this. We're not benefiting. You know, who's at the losing end? Women as a sex class, we're losing our rights. Young girls who are transitioning, who lose their fertility, who lose their breasts, who lose their voice. And young gay males. You know, when a young gay man transitions, he generally does the whole thing. He will be left without his penis and with a vagina that may or may not function. Usually not, right?
But by definition, it can't function.
Huh?
By definition, it can't function because it's not actually a vagina.
Well, it cannot function to give birth, but, you know, sometimes it doesn't even function to use for sex, you know. Sometimes it just grows together, you know, because the body does.
I would also point out that the vaginas on women have functions other than sex.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, but when a gay male transitions, he mainly wants to use, you know, the neo-vagina for sex. And sometimes he doesn't even get that. So he's left, you know, without basically a sex organ. So who wins from this? It's like the older heterosexual males who transition when they've already had kids. They've already done everything. They've had careers. They transition, you know, and then all of a sudden they're, you know, woman of the year, woman of this, woman of that, you know. So the people who are at the losing end of this theory are the same damn oppressed groups. It's women, it's gays, you know, it's young girls. It's the same people. So if this was like a progressive thing, wouldn't we see like trans men becoming presidents, trans men winning like male of the year, you know, trans men, if this was like some idea for women to finally, you know, make it by making ourselves into men, you know, we would see all that, but we're not seeing any of this. We're seeing the same shuffling of the cards in the patriarchal deck. The same males are coming out, you know, having different names and you know, identifying with different things, but it's still the same old males. And they really think we're that stupid that we're going to be like, oh my God, I so identify. I now feel that a female is like getting somewhere and I can do the same thing. No, I don't feel that way.
Well, I don't think that, I mean, I don't think that, I'm not disagreeing with what you say about, you know, they must think we're stupid, but I think that you don't You don't have to be stupid to go along with an ideology when you will have your life destroyed and you will receive rape and death threats if you disagree with it.
Yeah.
You can be terrorized into submission.
Yeah.
Which is what patriarchy has been doing for how many thousands of years now?
But it's really extreme now, because it's like, again, if we use the analogy of you know, male violence against women, it's like when you are really trying to, you know, protest and rebel and maybe even leave the relationship and like actually you stand up for yourself, that's when the violence gets really bad. You know, that's when you know you might die. And I think that's what's happening, because if we look at these 6,000 years, you know, we've done so much in the last 100 years. You know, and there was no way of coming at us from above, because we already had the tools, you know, the you know, not just the practical tools, but like, you know, language wise, we knew what to do. We were organized, we were formed. You know, most women, even if they weren't feminists, they knew that when a guy was calling us, you know, sexist slurs and stuff, we knew that that was bad. So this is coming from a whole new angle, you know, and I think, you know, what we're going to see in the next step of this is what's happening in Poland. Right. Where like, and what's happening in the US too, by the way, is like women are losing their rights to abortion. Right. And normal circumstances, you would have like a unified, organized women's movement, you know, consisting of women from all classes, social classes, you know, countryside, city, saying like, you know, we want to decide about our right to abort. Okay. So what instead happens is that that movement is now being fragmented by people saying, you can't say that just women have abortions, all genders need abortions, and this is really transphobic to say, and blah, blah, blah. And the spokesperson of the Polish movement, you know, for abortion turned out to be somebody who was either trans, non-binary or something, who used that extremely elitist language. And it was so easy for the extreme right to say, you know, what is this? They're just all fools. Look at them. Those are the people that want to have abortion rights. So, of course, you know, if you're just like a housewife, you're going to identify with that? No. So then they're just like, okay, we're going to cancel out abortion rights altogether. So in the long run, what's happening is the feminist movement is becoming irrelevant. It looks bad. It looks elitist. It looks weird. And then they can just dismantle our rights altogether. So we as women, you know, as feminists and as socialist feminists, which I happen to be, which not everybody has to be, but anyway, that's how I am. We find ourselves like between two fronts that, you know, are both trying to crush us. You know, from one hand, you know, they're trying to take away our rights to, you know, our own body. And on the other hand, they're trying to take away our name. So from women's right to have an abortion, what's left? Not the abortion and not the woman.
I know so many people, this includes men, but specifically women here, who old school lefties who now feel politically homeless because of all of this.
And that's the hard thing, you know, because the left is trying to cancel us. And sorry, like the left can't cancel me because I was the left before they were even born, you know. But when they try to cancel you, what happens is the right starts. There's this pull and push thing. So the left is trying to push you out. The right is trying to pull you in. And now if we do that, you know, we're going to have some kind of way of adapting to their arguments against gender identity theory, which are not our arguments, because, you know, we had different arguments. And I think that's also a danger. Like, how do we, you know, navigate in all this? What's going to be left of the left feminists in the end?
Do you have an answer to that question?
Well, I hold the line. I'm just trying to stay to what I am and my theory, you know, and I don't think I changed. I think they changed.
Oh, I completely agree with you. And there's a line I want to throw out. We're coming close to the end. There's a line I want to throw out. She said it much better than this, but basically Andrea Dworkin talked about how right-wing men think women are private property and left-wing men think women are public property.
Yeah.
And that line has really helped me understand, you know, the right wing with the woman's body belongs to the man, and with the left with its pushing of prostitution, pornography, and transgender ideology, where women belong to all men. And
yeah,
it's like, I don't even know why I bothered right after that line, because she said it all.
Yeah, but, you know, it's also relative depending on what context you're living in, because here, you know, in Sweden, we've had the abolitionist law on prostitution since 1999. So here, the left doesn't believe in prostitution. Here, the left is against prostitution. Here, everybody's against prostitution. So the same person here that, you know, would be super pro gender identity theory would be against prostitution and surrogacy.
That's really interesting, because in the United States, at least, those are all prostitution, pornography, and trans ideology and queer theory are all a suite.
Yeah. But
if you don't accept all of them and actively promote all of them, then you are an apostate and a blasphemer and a heretic, yeah, and must be destroyed.
But I think that just shows that you can change things. You can change things, but we have to organize. You know, we have to organize also within the left. You know, I think we can't just go out there like on our own and be like, hi, I'm just this like lonely person that believes this. You know, you're going to be crushed. Like, we have to organize like fractions and, you know, I don't know if whole parties, but at least like chapters within parties that stay firm on these things.
So
because it can't change. Like, that's what happened in Sweden. Like, we had the abolitionist law on prostitution, and now that's established. Nobody agrees with prostitution, at least not publicly.
That's great. So we're running out of time. Can you, okay, couple things. One is, can you sum up for everybody all the wonderful things you've said? And two, can you tell people how they can find out more about your work and about your most recent book?
Well, I think, I think my book is on online in English, in Spanish as well, and in Swedish. So whatever language fits you best, and it's going to come out in French as well. So you can read it. I think I wrote it. It was the first book in my country that was published on gender identity theory. So it has some overlapping with like Kathleen Stock's book, Sheila Jeffrey's book, Helen Joyce's book, for example. But it also has like other things. What I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to actually understand gender identity theory as a theory and trying to see where it takes us. I'm trying to take them at face value, trying to take their words literally and see where we end up, you know, trying to deconstruct the theory. So basically I get back into, you know, Marxism, socialism. I'm trying to have a take on this that differs from right-wing ideologists that would just say, well, this is just crazy, you know, it's just crazy, it's absurd, you know. Yeah, it is absurd, but it has, you know, structural relations of dominance in it, and that's what I'm trying to find. Where are the points? Maybe I'm getting too theoretical here, but you know,
no, it's great.
So I think it's better to read it than to listen to me now, because I think I sound extremely theoretical.
I think that what you said is great. Okay, absolute final words.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. And I know the U.S. is like a really difficult place to be in right now with all that's going on. So just, you know, sending you strength and, you know, knowledge is power. So educate yourselves.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world. And thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Kaisa Equus Ekman. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.